Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming crisis in Korea between the world's overwhelmingly nuclear-armed military superpower, the United States, and a delusional failed state that may or may not have a few deployable nuclear weapons, North Korea, with Secretary of State John Kerry warning to Pyongyang that the U.S. will not accept North Korea as a nuclear state. A veteran CIA operations officer, Robert Baird, joins us to look into the minds of North Korea's leaders who have seen Gaddafi give up his nukes and lose his life, and Saddam give up his WMD only to have his country invaded in search of them. Robert Baird has an article at Time.com, North Korea's Gaddafi Nightmare. Then we'll assess what kind of advice the president is getting from his national security and foreign policy team that is largely comprised of democratic liberal hawks, all of whom, except Obama, supported the Iraq War. Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Councils under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, joins us to discuss the imperial preening as the White House appears to be overcompensating in their reaction to the saber-rattling of a boy tyrant they refuse to speak with. Then finally, we'll examine Friday's federal court ruling allowing greater access to the Plan B so-called morning-after pill. While moving in the opposite direction, there appears to be a renewed war on abortion across the country as North Dakota, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Kansas pass laws banning and restricting abortions in defiance of Roe v. Wade. Sharon Levin, the Director of Federal Reproductive Health Policy at the National Women's Law Center, joins us to discuss the state of reproductive freedom in America. And joining us now is Robert Baird, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. He has an article at Time.com, North Korea's Gaddafi Nightmare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baird.
It's good to be here, Ian.
And in your Time piece, you point out that if North Korea is looking at Gaddafi, who gave up his bomb and lost his head, the lesson of – I'm just quoting here from your article – the lesson of Saddam's end is another cautionary tale for the North Koreans. If Saddam held onto his weapons of mass destruction, and lots of them, the Bush administration would have had second thoughts about invading his country. So I take it in a way that you could also extend that to Iran, could you not, Robert Baird, given that the talks, the P5+1 talks in Kazakhstan over the weekend turned out to be fruitless, and a lot of people are conjecturing that Iran has also learned the same lessons that North Korea has appeared to have learned.
Well, yes, I think you can look at North Korea, any rogue state, and they can go along with the program as Saddam's. I mean, Saddam essentially disarmed by the mid-90s. He didn't have anything to speak of, yet we went and invaded, and he did lose his head. You know, it's a lesson to any tin pot dictator that we are not going to play by the rules that we've established. And you, especially Iran, I mean, what are they, you know, they are, you have to look at them as almost right now is under siege. They're losing in Lebanon. They're losing in Syria. Iraq is on the verge of breaking up. You know, the Shia crescent that everybody was talking about is falling apart. And now, on top of it, come sanctions and promises. You know, they look at them as empty promises, is if they give up their nukes, if they stop enriching uranium, things will be fine. You know, they don't trust us, frankly. And for good reason. You know, and that's where we are now. And Kim Jong-un is the same way. I mean, he has referred – I wrote that article from people who know what's going on and go to North Korea all the time. He has brought up the Gaddafi example of he did disarm. He went along. He helped on terrorism. He helped with renditions and so forth. And yet when it came time for the regime was under attack, demonstrations, we helped assassinate him.
So what do you think, though, of what the U.S. government is doing in terms of handling this situation on the Korean Peninsula, where it appears that we have sort of gone along tit for tat with this delusional boy tyrant who may or may not have some deployable nuclear weapons, and we are, after all, the world's leading superpower, outspending almost half of the countries in the world combined with enormous military power. The asymmetry is extraordinary, yet if you watch the news and hear what the White House is saying, you would think that North Korea was a clear and present danger.
Well, it isn't a danger, and it's worse than not a danger. It's the North Koreans could be counted on to overreacting. They should have known this. As I wrote in my article, every single car accident, so I'm sure this is an exaggeration, but this is what people say, ends up in a fist fight. The Koreans don't give up. They're looking for a fight, and I think it's almost inevitable we're going to get one. But we treat the North Koreans as a poor relative. And yes, they are crazy, and yes, the leader does live in a bubble, but that's all the more reason to keep channels open and not, making ultimatums. On top of it, we don't have experienced people dealing with Korea. The commander of ground forces showed up to their command, essentially threatening North Korea, unprovoked. He said, we'll make a stand if we have to. It was a very bellicose arrival, as I understand, that the North Koreans noticed. And then you have a Korean-American ambassador who is a political appointee, is not really on strong political ground. So we've seen from the Obama administration, there's certainly no, at the beginning at least, no attempt to tamper this conflict down.
Well, I think worse than that, Robert Baer, last Tuesday, Secretary of State John Kerry meeting with the South Korean Foreign Secretary in Washington said that the United States will never, and warned the North that they will never accept them as a nuclear state. Well, that's never going to happen as far as the North's concerned. That's what they put all their eggs in that basket. They've impoverished their own people, many of whom are starving, in order to get nuclear weapons, if indeed they have them.
This is what we don't get, is that the regimes like this are only interested in survival. They're surviving outside invasions, Chinese interference, Russian interference. The United States bringing them down one way or another, and because they are paranoid and isolated, all they care about is staying alive. And they don't. If people starve, they would prefer they didn't, but they'll still sacrifice them in order to keep going.
So I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. He has an article at Time.com, North Korea's Gaddafi Nightmare. One of the things that troubles me about this situation on the Korean Peninsula and the way that the White House appears to be handling it and the press and by extension seem to be sort of beating the drum as they did with the Iraq War and with the Gulf War. It reminds me, or at least what I'm afraid of here, is what happened in November of 1983 when the Soviet Union almost went to nuclear war with the United States over Able Archer 83, which was a exercise that NATO did every year. And NATO's doctrine, of course, was to have preemptive nuclear strikes against the Warsaw Pact predicated on the idea that the Warsaw Pact had a preponderance of conventional weapons. So That was our policy. The KGB were watching for signs that we were about to launch. All of the NATO leaders went off to their bunkers. They were waiting for final confirmation that Reagan had gone to his bunker. And we almost it was worse than the Cuba crisis, but nobody knew about it at the time, and very few people know about it today. So, and it's all based upon perceptions, how the other side perceive you. So that's what we don't seem to get. Reagan got the message. That's why the hawk became a dove. He realized what was going on, and it changed him overnight. But I don't see that kind of realization and recognition amongst the liberal hawks on the Democratic national security team that surround Obama.
No, they keep making the same mistake over and over again, misjudging these second-tier powers like North Korea. They cannot conceive that they would take irrational actions which would lead to their destruction. They feel they have to bring the temple down, or at least go right up until then. But really what I think we're talking about here is no one wants to go to war. So war with North Korea would be devastating in so many levels. It's the accident. You know, every time on the demilitarized zone, you know, an American soldier puts a new belt in his machine gun, pops off three or four rounds, the Koreans answer with a dozen. It's just inevitable. It's always happened. Is an incident like that going to happen in North Korea? People are more scared they've been in a long time, people who watch North Korea. So, I'm not sure that all the bluffing is going to lead us to a war, but an accident might.
Well, you mentioned, Robert Baer, that the new U.S. military commander of the 30,000 U.S. troops that are essentially the tripwire there on the DMZ, that his remarks were bellicose and unhelpful.
It's a whole generation of military officers that marched into Baghdad in 2 weeks and say these are paper tigers. We can take them down. But no one is yet to contend with the destruction that ensues after a war like this or the unintended consequences. And that was the bad thing about Iraq. Not only did we invade the wrong country for the wrong reasons, but made a calculation of what this has cost us. It's incredible. I mean, it's like, and I'm going to have to say something about the drones in the Mazzetti article in the New York Times. We essentially killed people so that we could get overflight rights for the drones in Pakistan. And it's this kind of imperialist mentality, that we can get away with anything because it's the war on terror, is going to lead to some sort of widespread conflict or some other sort of catastrophe that we're going to pay a lot more than we have been in the past. It's just going to happen.
Well, in this case, we literally have 30,000 Americans there as a sort of tripwire, and then you've got the possibility of hundreds of thousands of South Koreans dying they're on a hair trigger on the north side. As far as I know, all of the artillery tubes and rockets are literally ready to go. And if you've been watching the footage from North Korea, they, as odd as it may seem to us, they really do see this young leader as their god. We may make fun of him, but they take him very seriously, and they take their threats.
Whatever they are, and don't ever forget, we run wars off intercepts. With North Korea, they know how to go radio silent when they're ready to move. They can launch rockets. They can move tanks. They can do anything they want without any spike in communications. It's amazing what they've learned to do. This is an army that's sophisticated in its own way, but could make an incredible surprise, when they want at their choosing. Could ultimately go be defeated, but at what cost?
And there's 1.1 million active in their army and 4-point-something in their reserve. So it's not small change. Now, just in the last few minutes, I'd like to ask you a couple of other questions since you spent so much time in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. Secretary of State Kerry just met with his Turkish counterparts and he warned Iran that the American patience wasn't endless in terms of these fruitless talks that went on in Kazakhstan. And I take it that, you know, the North, that the apart from the fact that there's an election going on in Iran, that basically they're looking at the same situation as the way the North Koreans are looking at it. But what about this idea that somehow we're trying to patch up the relationship between Israel and Turkey? Is that happening, and is that a precursor to something happening in Syria?
No, no one knows what to do with Syria. There is no solution to Syria right now. You know, the chance to choke off arms, to reach some sort of agreement, to, you know, actively participate in getting rid of Bashar al-Assad, not that that would have made a difference. That's long past. I mean, we are at a Somalia-like situation, which, you know, I'd served in Syria. I think it'd be very sad when that country is, as the destruction continues. I don't, you know, there's nothing that Turkey can do about it. There's nothing that Jordan can, you know. Unfortunately, the only people doing the real fighting are the Salafis, and they're the ones likely to come to power, in, for at least for a while. I don't think they're unified. You know, the only thing you can do is talk. But as far as the Israelis and the Turks securing the sarin and VX, they can't do it. You just have to keep their fingers crossed that a truly crazy bunch doesn't get them.
Well, apparently, there's within the opposition. There have been stories recently of the Salafists, the al-Nusra Brigade, shooting at people from the Farouk Brigades, which are the secular guys of the Free Syrian Army. So there's already been incidents of fratricide amongst the Free Syrian Army umbrella. But my understanding is that the recent Arab summit meeting in Doha, where the Syrian opposition took their place there and was seated in Syria's place, or Assad's place, I should say, that it broke up because there's a lot of acrimony between the Saudis, who are supporting the Salafists and sending their young dissidents who get out of jail free card to go and fight jihad, as they did in Afghanistan. But on the other hand, you've got the Qataris who support the Muslim Brotherhood, and apparently the Saudis and the Qataris are at loggerheads. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's these Muslim Brotherhood arrests through the Gulf, and the other Gulf countries accused Qatar, and Qatar is also, don't forget, is arming and funding Salafi/Muslim Brotherhood groups in Iraq, and there's a competition, as you said, between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. They despise each other, even though they seem like, you know, they hold the same ideology. But I mean, the unfortunate thing is that just a lot of money and weapons are being dumped into these conflicts, and it includes Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and you know, this is just going to be a long, long slog before this all gets out of people's systems. I just, you know, we're talking 20 years, and the outcome, anybody who says they can predict it doesn't know what they're talking about.
Well, I that's a good note of caution to end on. And I thank you for joining us here today, Robert Baer.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. He has an article at Time.com, North Korea's Gaddafi Nightmare. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how the White House appears to be overcompensating in their reaction to the saber rattling of this boy tyrant they refuse to speak with.
Recommended that I stay indoors because war is not the answer.
Me say the war not the answer.
Politician and them bubba niacin,
yeah.
War is not the answer.
War,
you know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer.
Tell
the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer.
I
think you know what the solution Rasta says,
yeah.
War is not the...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And I recall during the Cold War spending quite a lot of time with Soviet officials, at least those that one was authorized to speak with, like the Arbatov and the USA Canada Institute people. And invariably, you got the impression that they were more comfortable, the Soviets were more comfortable dealing with Republican foreign policy people and the Republican National Security Council and Republican presidents than they were with Democrats, who they thought were unreliable. And I'm just wondering at this point whether, given the disarray in the Republican Party, I don't think that, you know, the kind of deep bench that the Republicans used to have in terms of their national security people on various Republican presidencies, that no longer exists, I don't think. But on the Democratic side, it seems that you still have this tendency that the Democrats have always had to overcompensate, whether it was during the Cold War that they didn't want to look soft on the communists, and during the so-called War on Terror, they didn't want to look soft on the terrorists. And now it looks like they don't want to be soft on Kim Jong-un, which, given the stakes, makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. This is an inexcusable crisis, and perhaps the only thing worse than the crisis itself diplomatically is the way it's been reported and handled by the American media. Let me just recall a little bit of history here, because I think it's quite relevant. The dominant historical fact, of course, for Korea is that 3 million Koreans lost their lives in the Korean War. This is the indelible fact of modern Korean history. It's always there. The second relatively unreported reality was in a rather obscure and I think neglected Associated Press interview with Siegfried Hecker, who was a former director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. You probably know Sig, who has made a study of the North Korean nuclear program. And in this interview, was quite explicit in saying that yes, they may have a few weapons, but they've got a definite deficiency in fissile material. They're not really a nuclear threat, miniaturizing and doing the things they have to do technically to get those weapons on board missiles and to deliver them and all the rest. Is a daunting task, and they're still far away from any significant threat. So that specter, that looming danger of a North Korean nuclear strike, I think needs to be put in perspective. But let me go back for a moment and just look at the history of this, because it's a bipartisan disaster under both Democrats and Republicans. Only a few years ago, relatively speaking, 1994, we had a virtual thaw. You may remember that the grandfather of the princeling here, Kim Il-sung, approached the Clinton administration. There was a thaw in relations with South Korea as well. By the year 2000, there was an actual exchange of visits. The number two man in Pyongyang came to Washington. Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, went to Pyongyang, the first visit of its kind, of course, in history. But the Clinton administration dropped the ball on that diplomacy completely. The essential deal was to get the North Koreans out of the nuclear business, out of nuclear arms completely, in return for recognition and for some kind of detente, some kind of stabilizing agreement in East Asia. That didn't happen. The Clinton administration, along with a number of other issues, ignored this one to its end. The advent then of the Bush administration, brought us, of course, the axis of evil, North Korea defined as one of those evil regimes that had to be overthrown. And nothing was done about that. There was a complete cutoff of relations, of course, and by 2006, North Korea did indeed have a bomb. The following year, there was some hope. This is an up and down history, Ian. By 2007, we began the six-party talks: China, Japan, Russia, along with North and South Korea and the United States. There was actually an agreement to shut down a part of the nuclear facility, this cooling tower at Yongbyon that we've seen again and again in film footage being blown up, was blown up as part of that agreement. But with the advent then of the Obama administration in 2009, all of that diplomacy was basically abandoned. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton adopted what she defined as strategic patience as the U.S. policy toward Pyongyang. It was all predicated, of course, on the expectation of an imminent collapse of the regime in the succession crisis when Kim Jong-il died and his son took over. The collapse didn't happen. I think it's a classic case of no irrelevant experience being left behind here in American foreign policy. We never really understood the nature of this regime. Yes, it's brutal. Yes, it's a dictatorship. Yes, it's this absolutely exotic amalgam of a monarchy and a communist state. On the other hand, there is an element here which harkens back to what we know now from the archives of Stalinist Russia. There is an element of popular support, of nationalist rallying around the hereditary leader. There's a very, very strong military as well as a strong communist party that vie for control. This is not a collapsing or a dilapidated regime. It's proven its longevity over time. And, of course, the calculus of the Obama people, none of whom knew very much about Korea, North or South, that calculus was to rely on some kind of imminent collapse rather than to do anything at all to de-escalate or to defang the very a significant threat that was posed. Now we had a crisis like this at the end of 2010. The irony of that one, which ended, of course, after an exercise and after North Korean provocations in response to that, the irony was that quietly behind the scenes, we now know, there was an American delegation of former high officials, many of whom knew Korea, who had gone privately to Pyongyang and worked out an agreement by which the North Koreans would begin to ship out their spent fuel rods in return for, again, a normalization of relations, same thing they've been asking for years and years and years. You may remember that that the princeling here said to Dennis Rodman, our only diplomatic contact with them in recent years, have Obama call me. This is the essence of North Korea's policy toward the United States. They want desperately some kind of stabilization of their situation. They're suffering under the sanctions, and when they exploded their third bomb in this test in February, and of course when they sent the rocket up in December, the response of the international community and of the United States was to, as we do with Iran, was to ratchet down still more the sanctions, which led to this current. I would call it an escalation because I think it's probably more serious than any confrontation we've seen on the Korean Peninsula since the end of the Korean War.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. So, again, though, back to the what kind of a bench that we have in terms of foreign policy and national security advice President Obama's getting. I mean, all of his senior advisors in on national security and foreign policy are all of them, without exception, I believe, were in favor of the Iraq War. Obama being the only one who wasn't. That doesn't, I think, bode well. And it seems that you've got a bit of a repeat of history here, because when you talked about the deals that almost got completed under Clinton at the end there, that was preceded by another crisis in 1994, where you had people like Joe Nye at Harvard, one of the Democrats' foreign policy gurus, calling for a preemptively strike and remove with nuclear weapons any possibility of a North Korean nuclear program. And things got really tense there. Jimmy Carter had to go over to North Korea and intervene. So, you know, it goes back to what I was talking to Bob Baer about, is that we almost had a nuclear war with Russia, just blundering through an exercise that they misinterpreted, but we don't understand how other people see us. So there's a history here of even what Clinton did. And again, it gets back to this idea that I don't think the president's getting good advice.
Well, there's literally no one around him who knows Korea as a country, as a history, really, and really no one around him of any rank who knows East Asia. This is obviously not just a story of the two Koreas. The backstory here is the danger that, in response to this continued sort of mad cadence that we've gotten into with North Korea, that both the Japanese and the South Koreans may be eventually provoked to go nuclear themselves. It seems an unthinkable thing, but it's certainly there in the geopolitical background. You've got a president now, a daughter of Park Chung-hee, a conservative woman in Seoul, who is not a force for détente and for reconciliation. A different attitude in South Korea each time these provocations ratchet up a bit more. The sinking of the South Korean vessel in 2010 that was so provocative. This is not the Korea that it was in the 1990s when Clinton made what progress he made. And as you just pointed out, it was a very dangerous era then. I think it's useful to remember that you can't deal with any of these states without some kind of expertise. The last genuine expertise that any American president had was from Ambassador Christopher Hill. You remember that figure who was involved in some of these negotiations over the years. There's no one now of any stature who knows this new regime. Obviously, the success of the succession has rather shocked, taken Washington by surprise, how strong the new young leader is, how forceful and how bold, how practiced he seems to be in the politics of provocation. But I think there's absolutely no question that American policy for the last 30 years in Korea has failed and failed miserably. It's become now, Ian, and in terms of the inner reality here, the purview of sort of second-rate people in the Department of State and the field people in the Pentagon, the field commanders, as Bob Baer pointed out, who are invariably belligerent as well as uninformed. There's no real genuine expertise at the top or even in the middle, but we're going to have to talk to these people. It's absolutely insane that there should be any kind of confrontation like this, risking what it does, and to count on the Chinese once again to come in the back door and strong arm them, I think again is a sign of the lack of sophistication and understanding of the dynamic. The Chinese have a stake in North Korea in terms of a cheap labor pool and certainly their own prestige in Asia. These moves by the Obama administration in sending our stealth showcases there across the Pacific are just as threatening to the Chinese as they are to the Koreans. This is a show of American force and power, flexing of muscle, which is quite imperial in its method as well as its purpose. So the only sane course, of course, is to move away from this failed policy, to sit down again in the six-party forum or even by back channels, which would be, I think, very effective, and talk to these people about an accommodation, a detente with Pyongyang, which I think can lead constructively to an abandonment of their nuclear program, to an erasure of this threat, such as it exists. But Bob Baer is absolutely right. The danger of an accidental war with one of the largest armies on the planet, the danger of a gradual escalation, a tit-for-tat with South Korea, the danger of drawing the Japanese in to the nuclear circle, I mean, all of these stakes are just enormously high.
Well, I spoke recently, Roger Morris, with the former U.S. ambassador to South Korea and former CIA station chief, Donald Gregg, who was George H.W. Bush's vice president when he was vice president under Reagan. It was his national security advisor. And he was actually very surprisingly dovish. And he actually, as a lifelong Republican, he went out of his way to say how disgusted he is with the current Republican Party, thinks they're nuts and wants nothing to do with them, and is still worried about the neocons. But most of all, he said that he's in regular touch with the North Koreans, but they recognize that he's not in a position of power. And he just says, you know, they want to be talked to. And he's worried that this White House is full of people who have the investment in this idea that this is a failed state, North Korea, that it's about to collapse, that this kid's, you know, trying to prove himself, and that we can't reward bad behavior. So all of those tropes are still in play.
Absolutely, and I think they drastically underestimate the cost of an accidental war. The devastation to South Korea would be absolutely massive. There would be a general destabilization in the area. You know, Russia and China, no longer the adversaries perhaps that they once were, but Russia and China, but still to some extent, patron powers of Pyongyang. The Russians have sold them a number of submarines. The Chinese obviously have a huge financial as well as political stake there. This has all the earmarks of what Bismarck called one of those damn little things in the Balkans that started World War One. It engages none of the superpowers in any vital way. This is not, North Korea is not a threat to the United States in any sense. It's not really even a threat to the Japanese or the South Koreans. But it does, as Bob Baer pointed out, it does have an absolutely permanent desire for legitimacy, for its own survival. It sees that survival as dependent, thank God, on some kind of action by the United States. We have the magic bullet here. We can supply without losing face, without any kind of major embarrassment. We can supply them with the kind of recognition, the kind of aid, the kind of detente and disarmament deal that will put this crisis to rest and all future crises. But we're not responding in a reasonable or constructive way. I don't have any idea what Obama is thinking at this point. It's quite puzzling. He doesn't have anyone around him to really to tell him what to do.
And, of course, if he does anything reasonable, the Republicans are going to scream, sell out, cowardice, et cetera, et cetera. But
if he can't, let me just say, I think you're right about the Democrats and their perennial neuroses about the Republicans. But if there was ever a moment, this moment of ruin and rack and ruin for the Republican Party, when a Democratic president can afford to practice some kind of statesmanship, it's now. And in a theater of the world that we can afford to do that. Now, of course, Obama's pivot toward Asia is not just a tougher stance toward the Chinese. It can be a permanent nuclear free zone in North Asia, and that could earn him his Nobel Prize for real.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about greater access now to Plan B, the so-called morning after pill. At the same time, there appears to be a renewed war on abortion rights across the country.
Strikes now, so it would strike in me.
If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
Every sperm is sacred, every sperm is great.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sharon Levin, who is the Director of Federal Reproductive Health Policy at the National Women's Law Center. Previously, she was Vice President and General Counsel at the National Abortion Federation, a consultant to NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and Director of Advocacy at the Washington Area's Women's Foundation. Ms. Levin was also the co-chief counsel to Senator Charles Grass Schumer and Special Assistant for Women's Issues and Legislative Counsel to Congresswoman Nita Lowry. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sharon Levin.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian. And I loved the piece about the Monty Python song you played at the intro. Sometimes I feel like I'm living in that skit.
Well, I wish people had a sense of humor about it, but unfortunately they're quite passionate. And in fact, the passions are such that it's led to violence and the murder of abortion providers in this country, which I don't think happens anywhere else on the planet. Now that we're on that subject as opposed to Plan B, there appears to be a renewed war on abortion rights in the country at the state level. You've got North Dakota trying to ban all abortions, Arkansas banning them after 12 weeks, Mississippi has only one abortion clinic left, and now Kansas is getting into the act saying that life starts at fertilization. And, of course, in the Senate, you've got Senator Rand Paul, who a lot of liberals think is on their side. He's the sponsor of the Fetal Personhood Act, I think, isn't it called?
Yes.
So give us a sense of what's happening at the state level first before we talk about the federal level.
Sure. Although I do want to start with an overview, if that's okay with you. because I think we tend to parcel out the discussion, abortion and birth control separately, and it really is an effort we've seen nationally over the past few years about people feeling like they can make women's decisions about reproductive health care, whatever it is, for them. And I think most women know that politicians, their bosses, other people shouldn't be making these very personal decisions. Women should be able to make these decisions for themselves. And the fight is broader than just abortion, but let's start with abortion. Previous to this year, we had seen a huge increase in the number of bills enacted about reproductive health generally in the states and about abortion specifically. So in 2011, 135 provisions restricting reproductive health had been passed in 36 states, and 68% of those were restrictions on abortion. And in 2012, we saw 122 provisions enacted restricting reproductive health, and of those, 43 were restrictions on abortion. Most people who prognosticate the future of legislation don't think we'll see quite as many bills this year, but they're going to be far more extreme. And as you mentioned, in Arkansas, we've seen a 20-week bill pass that would ban abortion at 20 weeks, which is a law that the legislature there voted to override the governor's veto on, and it's a law that has been struck down in court at least three times before. After that, they went ahead and passed, and again, passed over a gubernatorial veto, a 12-week ban on abortion. These bills are clearly designed to go to the Supreme Court to try and challenge and overturn Roe v. Wade. North Dakota, as you mentioned, has also been looking at some extraordinarily extreme legislation. They passed a ban on abortion as early as 6 weeks, and the governor there specifically said it was about trying to figure out where states can ban abortion in the boundaries of Roe. So they're trying to overturn the decision and really take women back to a pre-Roe era, which is a very scary thought.
So when does it get to the Supreme Court in terms of being revisited or struck down? I mean, is this – obviously the purpose of doing all this is to overturn Roe v. Wade and to continually chip away at it. That appears to be the strategy. But is there a possibility that the federal courts or the Supreme Court will get tough and lay down the law?
I would hope so. It depends on the posture of the case that comes before us. And one of the things we've always feared is that the court will continue chipping away at the right to choose without ever saying the magic words for overturning Roe. And the reason that's a scary thought is because I don't think people understand, if they're not lawyers, how much this right has already been curtailed in the states. And unfortunately, the news tends to cover sound bites, and without the sound bite, we're overturning Roe. People may not appreciate just how bad it's gotten.
So in other words, at the state level, things have been rolled back considerably, and it's gone under the radar because people have this false belief that Roe v. Wade somehow operates nationally, which I suppose it does in terms of federal law, but that has not prevented this serious erosion of reproductive rights that has gone on at the state level.
Thank you for putting into very articulate terms what I was trying to say. Exactly.
So what is then, because, you know, at the time of this last Supreme Court hearing, there was talk about Prop 8 and DOMA. Mm-hmm. There was an article by Adam Liptak in the New York Times, and I had some Supreme Court watchers on talking about it. And the theory was that because Justice Ginsburg has said that she thought that the abortion, she's had some criticism of Roe v. Wade, thought maybe it went too far too fast, there was a concern that you know, a Supreme Court striking or allowing gay marriage, etc., would go too fast, too far. And everybody I talked to said that was somewhat ridiculous, but nevertheless, the idea is out there. So are we to believe that even the staunchest person on the Supreme Court, Justice Ginsburg, has some problems with Roe v. Wade?
I think I agree with your guest that said this is all a bit ridiculous. I think the argument that when it comes to people's fundamental constitutional rights, the court should slow down and wait for the states to catch up is an argument made by people who fundamentally oppose those rights. So in the gay marriage context, I believe it's 9 states now who have allowed marriage equality. That means that there are 41 states, and D.C. has allowed it. There are 41 states that have yet to do so. And the idea that somebody should have to wait until all 41 states catch up in order to be able to get married is wrong. Real people get true harm when the court waits to assert a fundamental right. So there are a lot of women, for example, who would not have been able to make the decision for themselves as to whether or not to go forward with the pregnancy and would have suffered the true harm of that if the Supreme Court hadn't decided Roe in 1973.
Well, as if we don't have the historical precedent of Jim Crow. Talk about
exactly.
Waiting. I mean, waiting for what? For decades and decades for rights that were already given, then taken away or not enforced. So,
right. I always think of Karamatsu when people talk about that, which is the case for people who don't know about Japanese Americans who were living in the U.S. during World War II were interred in camps. And the Supreme Court, in a case called Karamatsu, said it was okay to do that. And years later, the Supreme Court had to rescind the decision because it was obviously internment based solely on race and not for any reason believing that somebody simply because they were a Japanese American might be helping the Japanese in the war. And while it's lovely that the Supreme Court rescinded the decision, it doesn't help the people who were interred.
Again, I'm speaking with Sharon Levin, who is the Director of Federal Reproductive Health Policy at the National Women's Law Center. Previously, she was Vice President and General Counsel at the National Abortion Federation, a consultant for NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and Director of Advocacy at the Washington Area Women's Foundation. Sharon Levin was also co-chief counsel to Senator Charles Schumer and Special Assistant for Women's Issues and Legislative Counsel to Congresswoman Nita Lowry. Let's turn to Plan B and the judge on Friday in the New York Federal Court, U.S. District Judge Edward Corman, in a blistering opinion, struck down restrictions to those who can buy Plan B over the counter. And he really went after Kathleen Sebelius, and I guess by extension, President Obama. Is this now the law of the land that women can have unfettered access to Plan B over the counter?
The judge's opinion said that it had to be available in 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends, I guess, on whether or not there's an appeal by the government. I certainly hope there will not be. And that in this case, science triumphs. The science was very clear in this case that women of any age can use Plan B, which is, as you mentioned, a form of contraception. It's contraception you take after you've had unprotected sex. That women can use it effectively, and it's medically sound for them. And that it has to be the thing that determines when Americans get access to drugs, not people's personal beliefs about reproductive health.
So what I heard in the discussions in the last few days since this was that it costs $70. Is that right?
It can cost that much, yes. You can.
Is that just for one pill or one dose?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
That's true. If under the new health care law, if Plan B is prescribed, it can be covered by your insurance.
But that would require a young woman who'd had unprotected sex going to a doctor first and then
It defeats the over-the-counter rule, absolutely.
Yeah. So
it is still expensive.
Right. Now, is there a generic version of it?
A Plan B, I believe there is not, but I actually would have to check that. I don't know the answer.
I see. Because I'd seen somewhere, I thought, or heard somewhere, that in the judge's ruling, it also applied to generics. It may have been that he was doing that for future, whenever the patents expired. So what's the sense then? And we started out talking about how reproductive rights are being rolled back at the state level. How significant do you see this ruling?
I think this ruling is very significant. The background is that this form of birth control is medically safe, and that repeatedly the FDA, in reviewing this application, had said it was fine to be available over the counter with no restriction. And the government even raised this in their case defending their decision. In many cases where there are drugs that are safe but people would prefer younger people don't use them, they're available over the counter with a label that says not for people under 18. So the way that the government dealt with this is completely different than how they deal with other drugs that are similar. And I do want to note that those other drugs that they've allowed labeling for are actually quite dangerous if taken in large doses, whereas Plan B is not.
Wait a second, though. That at $70 a pop, who the hell's going to overdose on Plan B?
Well, that's true also. But if you take Plan B and you shouldn't, what happens is you get nauseous and your period is delayed. You don't get very sick. Whereas there are forms of cough medicine that can make you quite ill if you take too much of it. And the point is that not based on science or medical analyses, Plan B was treated very differently than other drugs, and it was treated in a way that kept it away from women who might need it.
For about a decade, right?
Yes, for a decade. They've been trying to get this changed for a decade. And so it flew in the face of science. And also, the other piece of background that nobody was talking about, although the judge rightly raised, is women have a constitutional right to birth control. And so this was, the judge's decision was clearly right based on the science and clearly right based on the law.
Well, Sharon Levin, I thank you for joining us here today. And we will see in whether there's an appeal. I think it was a political decision. I think the judge more or less said that, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
This was based on politics, not on science. Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sharon Levin, who is the Director of Federal Reproductive Health Policy at the National Women's Law Center. Previously, she was Vice President and General Counsel at the National Abortion Federation, a consultant for NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and Director of Advocacy at the Washington Area Women's Foundation. Sharon Levin was also co-chief counsel to Senator Charles Schumer and Special Assistant for Women's Issues and Legislative Counsel to Congresswoman Nita Lowry. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by